Empower Radio presents The Farkas Files, an exploration of energy, metaphysics, and the paranormal with David Franklin Farkas. The Farkas Files. The truth is in here, somewhere. Here's your host, David Franklin Farkas.
Good evening. Thanks so much for being with us. At least it's a wonderful crisp fall evening here in New England. Who knows what it's like where you are? You could be in Australia in summertime. I don't know. But thank you for being with us. My guest tonight is me. We decided to have some fun, and the wonderful Annette Rochelle Aubin, who was on a few weeks ago, suggested, why don't I interview you? You never get interviewed. So we're going to interview David Franklin Farkas this evening, and this should be hysterical, but we'll have fun. But first, tonight's metaphysical musing. And I've been thinking about, I live in one of those wonderful places on this planet where in the fall, the leaves turn amazing, amazing colors. And everybody knows the pictures of New England where the maple trees are bright red and orange and yellow, but there are trees that turn dark maroon with almost black undertones. And there's one species that, and it happens to be in this area, that turns mauve with kind of a pinkish color. I mean, there are amazing colors that come up. And this area is famous enough for this that people called the leaf peepers drive up here usually around Columbus Day weekend, which is what, next week, and just come up to spend the weekend and look at the leaves because it's gorgeous. And I drive around more than I usually do just to look at the leaves changing, and they seem to almost change right in front of you. It's amazing. You could drive past something in the morning and drive past in the evening, and the whole show is different. It's an amazing experience. But I got to thinking about the metaphor of the cycle of the year, and the fall is precedes the winter, which is the winter of my discontent, because I don't like it when it's cold and dark. But it's also the time when we're not doing the frenetic growth of spring, and we're not doing the stable growth of summer that feeds us and keeps life alive. It's the time when the green in the trees disappears and you get these amazing colors. And it's like, where do these colors come from? What does the tree do? What is that? And what's fascinating to me is the trees don't turn these colors. They were always these colors, but the green of the chlorophyll in the leaves covers it up. So during the time when they're growing quickly and there's chlorophyll churning sunshine into food and the leaves are making oxygen to keep us alive, you can't see these colors. And then as that fades and the moisture leaves the tree, they turn the color that was underneath, the color of what was always there. So in effect, they're showing their true colors. And people always use the seasons as a metaphor for the way life unfolds, the way an individual's life unfolds. So the fall is the time when you've done that frenetic spring growth and summer growth, and you've raised your family and you've done all of that stuff, and now you can relax into a new stage of life and literally show your true colors and do the things that you were never able to do, didn't have the time to do, or too busy to do, and learn new things and meet new people and all kinds of stuff that were not possible at another stage in life. And it's, depending on how you count those things, I guess that's the time of life that I'm in. Certainly my daughter just is in her second year of college. I just moved to a new place, learning a new area, meeting new people, and setting up my life to do some of the things that I always loved that I haven't been able to do for a long time. So isn't it wonderful that life unfolds in such a way that after we've done all the things we think we're supposed to do, and we've met our responsibilities, we get to show our true colors and do what we've always wanted to do. In the Hindu tradition, people have families in India very early. And so by the time a man is 50 or 55, he's met his social and family responsibilities. His kids are off into the world. And that's the point at which, if they choose to, they can find a guru, go up into the mountains and sit in a cave or do whatever process they're going to do for their spiritual growth. There are parts of the world where this time of life is the specific time for personal and spiritual growth. It's really interesting. So here we are celebrating the autumn, the fall. If you happen to be in the southern hemisphere and it's getting warm, well, that's wonderful too. It'll be fall. It'll be fall in a few months. So that's tonight's metaphysical musing. And now let me introduce Annette Rochelle Aben, who has been on before and is going to have a good time, or give me a hard time, interviewing me. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Wow.
Again.
Like I would intentionally pick on you. David. Seriously, DFF. I'm your BFF. Are you kidding me? I got your back, Jack.
I lost my head for a moment.
That's okay. I was just falling in line with what was going on, showing my true colors, so to speak.
Well, we're all in trouble now.
I know, and welcome everyone to the Farkas Files. It is my honor and pleasure to share with you for the next few minutes, or many minutes, depending on how long you want to stay tuned. I personally think you should stay tuned until we are complete. Why? Because there is so much to know about this man that you might not know, as well as things that would give you a grin if you just sort of remember that you've heard them somewhere before. And I promise you, you've never heard them from me. I stopped writing on bathroom walls a long time ago. So it's all good. It's all good. But David has, in my opinion, a most colorful background as an individual, as a creative, as an intuitive. However, what I know about David and how David sees David could very well be two different things. So, sir, David Franklin Farkas, who are you? Where'd you come from? What do you do in this world? I think that there's a little bit of explanation due here. So, sir, I put it to you and I leave it to you.
Who am I? Who am I and why am I here? That's the ultimate question, isn't it? We're all trying to find that out.
Absolutely.
You know, the quick and easy answer is to talk about the work that I do other than the Farkas Files and writing for The Magic Happens and other things, which is the healing work that I do, which is remote healing for real estate and properties that are having various problems, like houses that won't sell or houses with strange occurrences that are going on. Among other things, a lot of things that can be shifted with properties, and also doing healing on people and situations. Some of my friends call me from airports when they are totally unable to get on an airplane and all the plans are falling through, and I have a bit of a reputation for bailing people out on that kind of stuff. So, you know, I basically do shamanic healing work in the modern world. So one of my jokes is I'm the village healer for the global village. And then the question becomes, and as the story unfolds, how in the world did I wind up doing this? Because I started out as, as the old saying from the old neighborhood goes, a good Jewish boy from Brooklyn. I don't know how good or Jewish I really was, but that's my roots. And so I went through the public schools, which are amazing. And when I was the shop geek in junior high school, I just loved all the shops and making stuff. So when I was going through that transition from junior high school to high school, there was a major historic event, which is that the Sputnik satellite went up. And all of a sudden, everything in the United States became about catching up with the Russians and saving the world from the communist menace. And so since I was smart and I was good at math and science, and I had, good, as the quotation goes, good hands, I was supposed to become an electrical engineer and save us. So I took the entrance exam for one of the specialty high schools in New York City, Brooklyn Technical High School, and got in, which was terrifying. It was a huge building, 6,000 at the time. It was all boys, and it was basically Hogwarts for nerds. I mean, it was, you know, it was college prep level academics with an incredibly deep technical background. And I went into the electrical and electronics course. And of course, it was so long ago we used vacuum tubes. But the semester after
I remember vacuum tubes, that was only a day or two ago.
Exactly. The semester after I left the electronics lab, they converted it to transistors, not solid state, mind you, transistors. Long, long ago in a borough far, far away. And so I got this incredible background. My best friends are people I met the first day of high school, which is an amazing thing to have friends for that long with that shared experience. And we often sit and marvel at the education that we got and that there are very few people getting that kind of education anymore. The time and place were different, but also the education system was different, and the particular school we went to is amazing. So New York City also has public universities that are free if you meet the academic requirements. So I went to City College Uptown, which was almost as far away at the other end of New York City as you could possibly get from the part of Brooklyn where I lived. So I had a 2-hour subway commute and a half an hour walk each way, which was a 5-hour commute to go to college. And I was, you know, freshman calculus class was 8 a.m. I had been up since 5, and one of my worst memories was, you know, the class had blackboards all the way around the room, and I remember the first formula in the middle of the center blackboard, and then I heard my name called and looked up, and the room was completely filled with math. And the teacher was saying, "Mr. Farkas, can you answer this for me?" And I was like, "No, I was asleep, wasn't I? Sorry, was I snoring?" Which was pretty much the end of my engineering career. But I was very fortunate that somebody who had gone to the same school suggested that I go to the School of Education and check out the Industrial Arts Department, becoming a shop teacher. And it was heaven. I got to learn to do all kinds of amazing technical stuff, you know, working in wood and ceramics and metal, everything from sheet metal and ornamental steel work to silversmithing and jewelry. It was printing, all kinds of stuff. When people talk about typesetting, I actually did typesetting. So I had this incredible experience with that and had a whole lot of fun, which not that many people get to say about college. And also became seriously addicted to caffeine, as you might imagine, with that commute. And we were young, competitive guys, so we had to compete about our coffee consumption. You know, and it was percolated cafeteria coffee with an oil slick on the top. And we used to graph our coffee consumption so we could tell who was ahead. It was horrific. But on the scale of the many things you can be addicted to, caffeine is at the low end. So I'm glad that was my addiction experience and not a whole bunch of other things that other people were doing. So trying to compress this part of the story, the New York's education department was looking for a new graduate from the Industrial Arts Department at City College for this special program they were starting that had never been done anywhere in the country. And it was a shop classroom in a trailer that would be brought to elementary schools to work with the kids to see if they could improve academic performance by giving them hands-on activities. Which, you know, they needed someone who was really good at what they did as a teacher, but also someone who was crazy enough to do this, because it was nuts. And I did that for 5 years until the grant ran out. And that was, you know, I saw the writing on the wall, and then I moved out of the city and worked for 7 years at a residential treatment center. So those were that's my first career and my straight jobs, which were about as unstraight as you could possibly get. But along the way in this, there is a second theme that started when I was 9. And that starts in a playground in New York City. My cousin from California had come to visit, and he fell down and scraped his knee. And I knew in some deep, profound part of myself that I was supposed to know what to do. And I didn't know what to do. And it deeply angered me. I had to know what to do. And I started studying first aid and reading everything I could get on my hands on, including military combat, first aid manuals, all kinds of stuff. I was in the Cub Scouts, and by the time I was in the Boy Scouts, I was teaching first aid, and got all the Red Cross certifications, first aid, CPR, water safety instructor. I was a lifeguard for a while. It was all this stuff about learning how to take care of people and about emergencies. And then when I was 17, I was able to get on a rescue squad. I was so excited to be official and have some kind of credential and authorization to help people in an accident and that kind of stuff. But the communist menace was disappearing, so civil defense was disbanded, and the local governments had to pick it up, and we suddenly became part of the police department. So I suddenly became an auxiliary cop, which was amazingly strange, but also, especially since I was, you know, singing anti-war songs and part of the counterculture. I hate it when I lose my train of thought and there are no survivors.
I was going to say, I'm sorry, but the red zone is for the loading and unloading of passengers only.
Exactly. So the good news about that was that we were trained by the Police Emergency Service, who were the think tank for urban rescue. Almost everything that's done now was developed originally by the Emergency Service Unit in New York, and they were our trainers. They didn't let us out on the street a whole lot unless all hell was breaking loose. But the training was incredible. We learned stuff nobody else ever gets exposed to. I became an EMT, which was a long, complicated process, which we were the first EMTs in the New York Police Department, got in trouble for doing what we had to do as EMTs. There was a conflict in the regulations. And then I moved out of the city and stayed on ambulance corps everywhere I went. That was a whole major thread in my life. And it was the preparation for doing the esoteric healing work. But no, I didn't know it at the time. I had no idea that's what was going on. So along the way, I got a workshop here and there and learned to do hands-on healing and had a few other things go on that started moving me into a different part of the healing world. But I was still doing all the other stuff. And, you know, that meant that I could, when I got to an accident scene and as part of examining somebody, you run your hands over their limbs to see if anything's broken, whether they have any pain, except my hands would tell me where the breaks were very clearly. I knew exactly where they were and how to splint them. And later I could see where the breaks were. So I would just pull up and say to one of the other people on the crew, it's over here, splinted, it's broken there. Go, how do you know that? Yeah, whatever. So it was a bridging of two worlds, a bridging of the emergency medical stuff and the hands-on healing stuff and the beginning of psychic skills. And then, you know, in here, there's the third track in my life is relationships, obviously. And I had married my childhood sweetheart, who I had known since we were very young teenagers. And it was one of those things that gets called a starter marriage. You know, you've been together for a long time. You're out of college. You don't want to be in your parents' house anymore. What are we going to do now? You get married. 5 years into that, we realized that really wasn't a good idea. And fortunately or unfortunately, because it's good and bad, and I can't say that it was unfortunate, we got pregnant at that point and stayed together another 5 years, but it was complicated. So we're going to be coming up on a break. I'm trying to time this so we break at a good point in the crazy story. Yeah. So my father... My mother had died. My father went to California and had a wonderful time. He'd always wanted to live in California. He'd been there as a young man, and he was working with kids at a state school for the developmentally disabled. He became very well known out there. And through a whole very long, complicated series of events, he wound up seriously ill. Well, there were two incidents. He had a brain tumor, and I went out to help him while that was going on. I did the healing work that I did, and he went through surgery. Came out, and in 10 days was home with support services and, you know, getting radiation treatments and stuff. But he just breezed through that. A year later, he had a second brain tumor, and my marriage was falling apart. All kinds of things were completely up in the air. I rushed out there to take care of him, and all these people were waiting in his hospital room for me to come in, because he was going through some really strange stuff, and all his friends and his boss were there. And after I spent a little time with Dad and explained a couple of things to him, his boss took me aside in the hallway and pretty much out of nowhere said, "Do you know anything about psychic surgery?" To which my response was, "No, but if this is like all the other things that have been happening in my life, I guess I'm going to find out about it now." And he introduced me to someone he thought would be the healer that would turn things around for my dad, but what really unfolded was he was going to be my teacher. And along the way, someone else introduced me to a Cherokee medicine man who took me under his wing and supported me through my process with my dad dying, but also introduced me to all kinds of situations and people. So that was the turning point and a good point for us to get ready for the break. We're going to go to our usual break, and we will be back shortly, unless we, of course, get taller. This is David Franklin Farkas here being interviewed by Annette Rochelle Aben on the Farkas Files on Empower Radio. And we will be back in just a moment. Don't go nowhere.
Mind if I sit down?
Nope.
This coffee tastes like coffee. So what's going on?
Not much.
What's new?
Not much.
Okay, but can you please put the newspaper down while you say not much?
What newspaper?
This newspaper. Oh, dude! What happened to your face? I see one, two,
ow,
three, four, five, six,
ow,
seven. Dude, what is
ow
this? 11 pieces of toilet paper stuck to your face?
I'm shaving in the dark to save energy. I'm helping the environment.
That's a dangerous way to help the environment.
Well, sometimes you have to sacrifice yourself for the greater good.
Dude, there's an easier and safer way to help the environment without sacrificing yourself. Go green, go public. Take public transportation. It's good for the environment and you won't have to live behind a newspaper.
Wow.
But for now, put the newspaper back up.
A message from the public transportation systems across the country. To learn more, visit publictransportation.org.
I'm home where I belong. I'm home and I love it. I'm home where I belong.
It's always nice to come home, but these days, many Americans are at risk of foreclosure and losing their homes. Fortunately, help is available. Making Home Affordable is a free program from the U.S. government that has already helped over 1 million struggling homeowners. And we want to help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
And I love it. I'm home.
I'm home.
Find out now what your options are. Go to makinghomeaffordable.gov or call 1-888-995-HOPE. The sooner you act, the better chance we can help you.
I'm home.
I'm home.
Where I be.
Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Sassy. Sassy.
This week's episode, Danger at the Old Well.
Last one to the old well's a rotten egg.
Ha-ha, I win. Whoa! Ah!
Sassy! Johnny fell down the well.
I'm wet.
What, Sassy? You know where Mr. Gunderson keeps his rope? Go get it, girl. What? You'd rather use this time to set people straight about shelter pet adoption?
I'm cold.
People shouldn't be afraid to adopt from a shelter? Because shelter pets are screened for sound health and temperament?
I'm wet and cold!
Sassy, what about Johnny? What? Let Johnny sit in the well until he learns to be more self-reliant? Sassy!
What'd he say?
Sassy is brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org. Remember, adopt!
Now back to the Farkas Files with David Franklin Farkas on Empower Radio.
And we're back with my guest, me.
That's right. And I'm Annette Rochelle Aben, and this is fun because, you know, I know that David does intuitive work and house clearing and cleaning and all the wonderful things that if you dig a little into the individual that is David and it's househealing.com, you're going to find out more than you probably ever dreamed you didn't know. And yet to hear it come directly from you and watch the progression of energy, I think it's fascinating, because one of the things that most people ask someone who has developed the abilities that you have over the years and uses them is, when did this start? And when did you know? And why did you keep pursuing it? And we've heard a lot of that in the first part of the show. So to find out where you've developed it to, how you developed it, and where do you see it going at this point? Because, you know, what worlds haven't you figured out yet? No, but I meant that seriously, dude. Because,
right. Well,
you know,
no, I'm just laughing because most of the time I can't say that I don't know anything, because there are some things that you do over and over again and they work pretty much the way you expect them to. But, you know, we all know so little about anything. The fact that you know a little bit about something that's really unusual doesn't mean you know a lot. And
well, what else is there left to know? I mean, because there are a lot of people, like, you got to think the late Sylvia Brown. What else could she do? Seriously. I mean, where was she taking what she had or developing it further, or what else is there to explore? I mean, I know you're not one of the people that's buying the one-way ticket to Mars, because I know you well enough to know you're not doing that. So, you know, as you move through the rest of this, you know, maybe kind of guide us into, maybe there's something in the realm of paranormal or metaphysics or psychic energy that you haven't pursued yet.
Okay. Well, let me continue the story and see if I can do a condensed version.
Okay.
So here I am out in the West Coast, taking care of Dad, and it became very obvious that he was pretty much done and he was just going from healer to healer to satisfy me. So I shifted my focus to putting everything in order so that he could leave when he was ready to leave, supporting him in his dying. And the medicine man, Kitoa, supported me in ways that I never would have expected, you know, in quotation marks, the medicine man to support his white protege. I mean, he showed up at the door and held my hand for hours while Dad was getting close to transition. And I, you know, spent a little more time after Dad died and cleaned up his affairs and the relationships that with people that I had met. And the last person that I said goodbye to was Kitoa. And I went over to his house and he said, "So you coming back?" I said, "Yeah, I think so." He said, "You know when?" I said, "No, but if this conversation goes like all the others, you're going to tell me." And he said, "Oh, yeah, well, come pick me up." Gave me a date and a time. You know, there's something I think you should see. Tells me nothing. So I go home. Depending on who you talk to, I did a okay job or a terrible job of cleaning things up with the divorce and the house and the relationships and whatever else. Bought a new truck, drove cross country in 4 days. I always threaten that my memoir will be called 200 Miles Before Breakfast. And dumped my stuff in the little place that I had rented and ran over to Kitoa's house to pick him up, and went off to a reservation in the middle of California to have a life-changing experience. He just dumped me in the middle of, "Oh, I can't stay. You have to take me home. Pick me up on Sunday." Left me basically by myself in the middle of 5 days of ceremony, which was incredible. Just absolutely incredible. And he kept doing that kind of stuff. "Oh, yeah, I got to take you. I need a ride." And he would take me places. And my other teacher, Greg, was trained in the Philippines by psychic surgeons. And I had a weekly appointment to go see him as my apprenticeship. And sometimes he'd work on me. Sometimes he would have someone, a client, on the table, and he'd have me work on them. Sometimes we'd sit and talk. There was no structure to it, of course. How could he have structure to a shamanic apprenticeship? And to give you an idea, one night I was driving back from somewhere and my guides gave me a very clear message: stop at Greg's house. That was like 8 or 9 o'clock at night. I ring his doorbell. He's like, "What are you doing here?" "I don't know. They told me to come over." So, okay, come on in. And the phone rings and there's a woman shrieking terribly on the phone, and he calms her down, pulls paraphernalia out of drawers, looks at me and says, "So you want to do an exorcism?" I said, "Yeah, I know. I came by for something." And had an extraordinary experience doing that with him. So a lot of the training was like being thrown in the deep end of the pool when you least expected it and having them just watch you and go, "Yeah, he's not drowning. He's doing pretty good." Very, very strange stuff. And, you know, along the way, one of the things we did a lot was clear places in space. And that, you know, years and years later, I realized that nobody else was really doing it, and it became a specialty. But, yeah, I did that for 3 years, working with the two of them. A year and a half of that, I ran out of places to stay and lived in my camper while I was working nights at a locked psych unit. So I was in a place where people were locked up because they could hear voices and I could see who the voices were talking to them, which was, I guess, what I needed to do for myself to realize what crazy is and what crazy isn't, because they had voices and they couldn't integrate it and they couldn't take care of themselves. So they wound up in a hospital. My joke is they couldn't wipe their own ass. But in another culture, they would have been identified as somebody with profound spiritual gifts that would have been nurtured. So it was very strange, and it was really an odd way to do it, but it was an incredible walkabout. The 3 years was a walkabout, but that last year and a half was an extraordinary experience. And when all that was done, I had an opportunity to go to Haiti for 3 weeks to do medical missionary work. And I wound up staying there 3 months because people didn't want me to leave and kept giving me places to stay and making arrangements. And it was an amazing thing to do. And I firmly believe that everyone in first world countries should spend a few months at least living in a third world country, especially a military dictatorship, because it straightens your head out really fast. You figure out what's important and you figure out how to have relationships with people that keep you safe. So that was another pretty amazing thing. But eventually I wound up back on the East Coast. And eventually I wound up in Massachusetts rather than New York, and had a 10-year career in energy conservation, inspecting houses and recommending changes and running programs and assorted other things. And you know the secret and how to manifest and all that stuff, and they tell you how simple it is. Well, I came back from my experiences, and what I basically very emotionally was saying all the time was, I just want to do energy work. I just want to make my living doing energy work. So I got this 10-year career in energy conservation doing energy work. And it was, you know, one of those screaming at the sky, "No, you knew that wasn't what I meant." Okay. Whatever. Thanks for the job. So, you know, there's more detail, and there's a whole second family and my incredible daughter and all kinds of other stuff that's happened along the way. But that's the basic framework of how I wound up here. So your question is fascinating. What else is there to do?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you've done a lot. You know, setting type is something that obviously people in this day and age, and I'm speaking people who might even be in their 40s, seriously, would look at you and go, "Doing what? Mm-hmm. Setting type? Doing what?" Because just as short time ago as 34 years, which would have meant 40-year-olds would have only been 6 at the time,
right?
They switched to doing computer generated things, which we all do now and take for granted.
Well, I also, at at one point I was writing about a piece of computer software, CorelDRAW. There were half a dozen people on the planet that wrote about it, and I was one of them. And learning all the nuances of computer illustration and typesetting. So I had a business where I did illustration using CorelDRAW, and I wrote about CorelDRAW until the computer magazine industry failed in a six-month period, which was amazing to watch it go up in smoke. And I shifted my focus to having my home business be doing the healing work, which I had been doing all along, but had other things on my plate to make money. And then I started really focusing on this. So what else is there to do? The big thing to do right now, the big challenge, am I going to say this out loud? If I want to look at the circumstances on the planet right now, but especially the circumstances in the United States, the United States and the Middle East, it appears that my country and a substantial part of the world have become psychotic. And I would guess bipolar, but it's just there's really crazy stuff going on. And what I know from the work that I do and what I can see is that all of the manipulation that's setting this in motion and the power behind manipulating all the people that are doing the horrible things is demonic. And one of the things that I do that there are not that many people on the planet that are capable of or willing to do is addressing dark entities in doing clearings. So I deal with that stuff. And it's dangerous stuff. You don't do it when everything is not right to do the work. And we're in this profound transition on the planet. The reason that things are as chaotic as they are is there's always a period of chaos before a major transition. And this is such a big transition that the chaos is almost overwhelming. So the appearances, you can look at the appearances as, oh my God, everything's going crazy, or you can look at it as this was exactly what to expect before the major shift in consciousness that's going to happen on the planet. But since I do this work dealing with the dark stuff, and since I can see how non-physical, unseen, dark forces, I could give them other names, but they're all more loaded than saying that, are creating this mess. What is my job? What is my role in shifting that? And at what point do I need to gather a team together to do it? At what moment, because it's got to be the right moment, can we do what certain kinds of things that will make them unable to do what they're doing? And to give you an idea what this stuff is about is I know by making this statement publicly that I've just increased the danger in my life. It's very serious stuff. And there are people that are going to listen to this and think that I'm a totally paranoid, crazy person. And I wouldn't blame them because they have no personal experience of what I'm talking about, and there's absolutely no way to understand that if you don't have personal experience, which is true of many, many things in life. And just because you don't have the experience and you don't believe the experience is possible doesn't mean that it doesn't happen. It just means you have no way of understanding it, which is the argument between psychics and skeptics all the time. So that's the big thing that's out there, that's on the plate, that's, you know, okay, so what's going to happen next? What's the next task that I will be given in this transition? So, and how am I going to rise to that occasion, and what skills do I need to develop, and what else do I need to know to be safe doing it and to make that happen?
And what about other people? I mean, you know, everything that you're talking about with the work that you're doing energy-wise and the paranormal and dealing with the energies on the other side, at this point seems to be very singular. You're doing this, and you had all these mentors and teachers and all these, you know, sadistic creatures that tossed you into the snake pits and said, here, and if you walk out of it, then we'll throw you over here to the monkeys because they've got sharp teeth too. So the idea is, are you actually working with and mentoring people right now, or is that not the calling or the path that spirit has laid out for you? Because I believe that we mentor with every breath we take. It's not
right.
Study with me.
Well,
or whatever.
The writing and this kind of radio, but especially the expansion of writing, which you're encouraging me with and are going to help me with, is going to be part of that.
Okay.
You know, the way that shamans teach is by telling stories, and there are stories to be told. There's information that I can get out there, and undoubtedly there'll be some speaking stuff and things. But I've always said I'm willing to be famous for 3 years to make a lot of money so I don't have to ever do it again. Because celebrity is a total pain in the neck. You completely lose your privacy. You know, yeah. It's like, okay, if I have to do that, I'll do that. But yes, there are things to be taught. And I need to find the ways to do that and to tell those stories and find the audiences that are ready to listen to them. The issue with apprentices, and I get this, I haven't gotten it lately, but I for a while I was getting it all the time. I want to do what you do. And my immediate response is, no, you don't. You seriously don't. This is... You know, some of it is straightforward and you get to do it and it's fun and you get results and people are flabbergasted that you get results and that's all gratifying. And some of it is serious and dangerous. So in order for me to take on an apprentice, it's got to be someone who's been working for 10, 20 or 30 years developing their chops to the point where weirdness does not bother them at all. And, you know, they are that grounded and solid in their knowledge of how the interaction of the physical world and the non-physical world that I can then take them another step with me so that I've got their back until they can do it on their own safely. And I've run across one or two people that I thought might be, though, you know, ready in that way. There are a lot of people that are teaching the basics of this kind of work, and I get to teach some of my methods at dowsing conventions and other things where I'm basically teaching techniques rather than, you know, tricks that I use to collect data and that kind of stuff. But in terms of doing the nitty-gritty work, that's a real apprenticeship. It's not doing workshops or assorted other stuff. And there are a lot of people doing very good workshops, especially for beginners. So I've never seen that as my role. And there's a part of me that feels it's arrogant for me to say that I could. You know, I know stuff, but I also know that it took me 30 years to get here. And it took that 3-year apprenticeship to create a transformation in me. But then it took another 20 years to integrate it before I could do what I'm doing. So it doesn't happen in a weekend workshop. And it not only doesn't happen if you try to do it in a weekend workshop, people will get themselves in trouble.
Right.
You know, oh, now I know how to do that, you know, which is where we all start. Everybody starts as a wannabe and a dilettante. look, I'm getting some results. Now I'm a shaman. Not right. Exactly. So especially now with the energy is so high and the stakes are so high, it's like, no, I'm not. That's not what I want to do. So, you know, part of it is I can only work on certain days at certain times when, you know, there aren't solar flares and lunar events and assorted other things and my body feels grounded and all the rest of it. It's got to be right. Because if I go into it and I run up against something serious and I'm doing it at the wrong time, I could be in real trouble. So besides being sort of semi-retired and, you know, grumpy old hermit, I also can't predict at what moments in the week it's going to be the right time to work.
Right.
And then I sit down and do as much as I can do until it's too much, and then I stop until the next moment of time when I can do that. And it's, you know, as the old commercial went, what a way to run an airline. Because you can't predict a lot of the, you know, people say, when is it going to be done? Like, I don't know. Sometime soon.
but it's an honest response. You know,
right.
I would rather hear what you say, the way you say it, like, look, you know, I can't predict this, I can't predict that, but I can do what I can do, than to hear somebody say, okay, I'm going to do this, and you let me know when you feel the change.
Right.
What the hell kind of answer is that?
Exactly.
If they pass gas, they're going to feel a change. They're going to think you're, you know, they're going to think you're, you know, Muhammad off the mountain again, really seriously. So,
well, and yeah, which is what I'm trying not to do. So you don't have the clock in front of you, but I do, and we've only got a few minutes left.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much for making me do this.
Well, you're so welcome, and thank you so much for allowing me to be a part of it. We got to stop meeting like this. People are going to get suspicious.
Well, we've got to do some of the wonderful stuff that you can do for me and that we can do together.
Exactly.
So, yes, you know, that part of what you were asking was what's next. And a big part of what's next for me is getting the books written, some of which are half written and some of which are written in my head.
And I will help you in every way that I can, Sir David Franklin Farkas.
I know you will.
And get those together.
I know you will. So stay tuned, boys and girls. There will be books and who knows what else that will come out of this. But, you know, and on the mundane side, I just moved. I'm still moving in. There's boxes and stuff everywhere. I don't know where things belong yet. And, there's all the stuff of life that has to be sorted out and worked out. But the place that I landed, this piece of land, is very, very special and I know is going to be a big part of my work once I settle in. So it's an interesting transition, as it always is. It's an interesting time to be on the planet. It's an interesting time in my life and the changes in my life. And it will I'm as curious about how this is going to go as anyone else is.
Alrighty. Well, I'll look forward to seeing the flares, solar or otherwise, that you send up to let us know what's going on.
Exactly. And I really appreciate the help you've given me already, but your offer of help with the books, it's going to be great. So I got to do the host thing.
All
My
right.
host has been Annette Rochelle Aben. Thank you so much for doing this with me. It's been a blast, and I hope that people have enjoyed hearing me tell my story, or at least not been bored to tears. My guest tonight has been David Franklin Farkas. You know.
You've been the BFF to the DFF. It's
right.
That's going to be a tagline from now on.
So if after all this, you're not, you know, running off into the hills screaming, thinking that I'm totally out of my mind and you're curious about my work, you could go to househealing.com, and cleverly hiding in plain view on the contact tab is every conceivable way of getting in touch with me, including a scheduling calendar. I do a 20-minute free assessment of what's going on in your situation with a person or a place or whatever it is. Please take advantage of that. If you want more information about the show or the show archive, you can listen to all the many, many years of shows that are in the can. Go to thefarkasfiles.com, where also you can listen live Thursday nights, obviously, on empowerradio.com. The show is on at 9 p.m. with reruns every day except Thursday, which is a new show each week. And we're on iHeartRadio, Stitcher, and a whole bunch of other live streams. So we're easy to find. And I am so excited that there are so many people out there that listen to us every week and make us part of your week. And I get emails and messages and people tell me that it's been helpful. And that's so gratifying. So until next week, this is David Franklin Farkas for the Farkas Files. The truth is in here somewhere on Empower Radio. Have a fantastic week.